for a drink. Now, she's from Toronto.
Originally.
But she's living in San Diego for years and years now. And she's like, oh, my God, it's like crazy. I need gloves.
I wanted gloves. Seriously?
It's cold.
I was here a month ago. It was not that cold.
Yeah.
What happens to people when they start living in warmer climates? They turn into,
They get soft.
They get soft.
Yeah.
You get soft in lots of ways as you get older.
Well, before we talk to Michelle, we need to do a little bit of business.
Oh, yes. Let's do the thing.
Let's start with Better Known Framework.
Awesome.
Just imagine the crazy music right now.
Yeah, right. It'll be there. You're watching the sausage being made, and none of what we just said is going to show up in the show.
It's called Network.
Right. Yeah. Everybody say hello to Brandon. Brandon's going to edit the show. We love Brandon.
Brandon's awesome.
Yeah, he's going to make the show amazing. So, yeah, every bobble, all those things are all going to get fixed.
This is a Thursday show, then.
This is a Thursday show. Oh, no, I've got it all.
All right.
I fought Smella. All right. Okay. Coming out of the edit point, Brandon. Thank you.
Don't you usually say, so what do you got?
Got out of the edit point again, Brandon. So, Carl, what you got?
Well, other than some really crazy music, I found this great blog post. If you go to tinyurl.com/win8chat.
Win8chat.
Win8chat. This guy, Gaurav Mantri, he has a great blog, and this is how I built an awesome chat application for Windows 8 with Windows Azure Mobile Service.
Wow.
What I like about this, he goes down the timeline of this entire project, which uses Node.js, and it's a Windows Store application, but it starts with meeting with boss. Check this out. His meeting with boss. Boss, we need a chat application for our company. Me. Okay, let's get Skype on everybody's computer. No Skype. Okay, how about other chat applications? No. We need to build our own. It has to be a Windows 8 application. Okay, what else? Should scale up to thousands of users. Me, thinking, dude, we only got 7 people in the office, but whatever. Me, what else? It should be cheap. I don't want to pony up large moolah up front. Understood. What else? That's it. So then the guy goes to his thinking chair. And then he comes back to the boss, and, you know, so it starts, the guy's got a really great way of explaining stuff, and he talks about the steps from installation to setting up an account in the store, in the Windows Store, creating his demo page, and basic, you know, side stuff about implementing CRUD operations. Like, this is a really nice walkthrough for anyone who wants to do a Windows Store application, and along the way, you're going to learn about push notifications.
Nice.
You know, push notification kind of an important thing, right? In the Windows Store app, you need to send something to it without having to pull for it.
What a great find.
Yeah, this is great stuff. We're going to have him on the tablet show.
Yeah, okay.
And by the way, if you don't know about the tablet show.
Who listens to the tablet show that's here in the room? Oh, wow, look at that. And I appreciate the applause for an audio show.
Yeah, that's great.
Putting up the hands. But, yeah, a handful of folks here.
So the tablet show was started last year. Richard and I have got 50 or so episodes, and we got back from build, and we decided, you know, there's a lot more to this than .NET. And so we wanted to focus on heterogeneous mobile devices, tablets, phones, not just Windows phones, obviously, Android, iOS. And we went out searching for guests that are really doing those apps and succeeding. And, you know, where they're failing, where they're succeeding, what their stories are.
And, of course, this point in the cycle, where we've got so much focus on Win8, so there's been a lot of Win8 shows lately, and it sounds like this would be a great one.
Yeah, so we got to have this guy. It's at thetabletshow.com. And like I said, it's 45 minutes to an hour or so. We just looked at the stats last night. Of all of the flop shows, this one is growing the fastest.
Well, it's fun that we started the show in 2011 after having show. I mean, Don and Rock started in 2002 before the word podcast even existed.
Right.
So now starting a new show, yeah, it's growing quick. I commend it to your listening. It's completely free. And it's supported by advertisers like all of our shows. So please give us a listen and give us some feedback.
Well, there's one other thing we want to say before we start the show. Two other things, actually. But we want to talk about our conference in Las Vegas for the listening audience. This is Dev Intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that we have put together, Richard and I, with our friends. Our goal is to do a more agile, heterogeneous show. And that means that we're going to be talking not just really, that means we're talking about JavaScript, okay?
Yeah.
This is really what it comes down to. No. Scott Guthrie's going to be there. Scott Hanselman's going to be there.
Michelle's going to be there.
Michelle's going to be there. Richard and I will be there. The Franklin Brothers Band might be there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand. The big draw for that is that we negotiated a rate of $65 a night for you.
So you come down for a few days in Las Vegas, and everybody who signs up by November 1st gets a ARM tablet, one of the new generation tablets. So if you'd like a tablet, you know, if you...
Where do I sign up?
Yeah, you're coming already. You're there.
But
so
if you want to know, it's devintersection.com, December 9th through 12th.
All right.
Okay, before we go any further, I need to tell you that Pluralsight offers...
Wait, at a point. You're cutting out my piece.
Oh, dude, I totally cut out
you. You cut out my piece.
Sorry, that isn't at a point.
There you go.
Hey, Richard, who's talking to us?
Grabbed a comment off of show, you're going to love this, show 801, which is the show we did with one of our hosts, Joan Rosenblatt, when he was talking about Azure's new features. And this is a comment by a fellow whose pseudonym is Curious Techie, but his actual name is Brett Robichaud. He's out of Oregon, and he says, just wanted to comment on the concept of backing up your Azure SQL database. Yes, Azure keeps three replicas of all SQL databases, so you're well covered for hardware failure within the Azure data center, but there are two scenarios that these replicas do not help you with. One, you submit a rogue SQL query that screws up your data. In this case, all three replicas are now screwed up and you have nothing to fall back on. Or two, the data center you're in fails in entirety for an extended period and now you have no access to your data. Making your own backups are the only solution to these two problems today. This is an area where Azure is sorely lacking. They need to be able to enable customers to restore backups of their databases. I mean, Azure keeps backups, of course, but customers have no access to them. Azure should also be allowed to fail over to a replica database in a different data center. Both these features are promised. But until then, it's your own responsibility to keep backups. Now, Brett, the three replicas include one that's always in a different data center. And we've already run into this.
Oh, my God.
Yes, we have, haven't we?
Yeah, get date.
Yeah.
That changes.
Yeah.
And the cloud.
Depends on which data center your stored procedure runs in, you'll get a different time.
Yes.
Ask us how we know.
So, you know, you might have noticed that sometimes .NET Rocks shows published early. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Well, they're actually in the feed before the next day comes, and that's because we ran into problems. Our stored procedures are actually calling get date.
Yeah.
Which is going to be sometimes in UTC.
Turns out, yeah, when you don't own the SQL Server anymore and it roams around the globe, time changes.
Yeah, so there is a get
UTC date. Yeah, this is a work we've done during the road trip to get it straightened out.
That'll
good fun.
Universal time.
But the other scenario we painted there, that you can shred your own database, absolutely true. Ask me how I know.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it. So keeping your own backup, I mean, it would be nice if we could tell Azure, hey, take a snapshot of my database as it is. Okay, restore from that. That's not, that functionality I'm sure is coming, but it's not there yet.
Yeah.
One way or the other, Brett, you don't have to be right to get a mug. So a mug is on its way to you. And if you'd like a mug, just write a comment on the website at donnerrocks.com.
Edit point to Brandon, switch that. Reverse it. Scratch that. No, put Richard after me, after my better known framework. And then we'll go into Devin reception. And now into Pluralsight.
Okay.
And before we go any further, I need to tell you that Pluralsight offers developer training online with experts such as people that you hear on this show. They offer 300 courses plus, and they offer 8 to 10 new courses every month, and all sorts of stuff that they can cover. Just about everything on the Microsoft stack, plus iOS, Android, Java, a whole bunch of stuff on Windows 8 and Windows Store apps. So check them out, pluralsight.com, and subscription starts at $29 a month. With that, let's reintroduce Michelle Leroux Bustamante, who needs no further introduction. Give her a big hand again. Last time we were on the show, we did the traditional Michelle ends the show with a dirty joke, which you always do. So we would just like to tell people that on this show, you're not going to hear the entire joke. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Carl.
You're just going to tell punchlines.
There's a plan.
We're just going to do punchlines.
But that's at the end.
Yeah.
This is the beginning. And I really enjoyed your presentation you did here. I know the listeners didn't get to see it or hear it, but we're going to certainly talk to it. But this whole, how startups have evolved and how important the cloud is in that, I'm on board 100%. Can you give us like a one-minute synopsis of that sort of point of view?
Well, it's really about the fact that, you know, in general, we've evolved to the point where cloud is a commodity.
Right.
Hosting is a commodity. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, IT, parts of IT operations are a commodity.
Sure.
And it needs to be that way
mm-hmm.
in order to be successful as a business these days. Because, you know, we need to be able to focus on our business, our core business, not on, you know, other things that are just security related, should be commoditizable, hosting should be commoditizable. Anything you can delegate, do.
Right.
And so I think that that's what's pushing this more than anything, and also this growing, I guess, trust. Even though everyone's afraid, they're trusting to some extent, cloud vendors are doing their job. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago when I did, you know, software as a service, which we called ASPs,
right.
We had to work really hard to get trust.
Yeah.
Really hard.
It certainly has moved on, but I think the biggest thing here is we've just driven down the cost of doing a startup dramatically to the point where...
Like to zero?
Yeah.
Except for your time, which is worth a lot. But,
sure.
I mean, if you have an idea and you're a founder, you know, you gotta work, right?
You know what's great about the cloud is that it's the hardware stuff that goes away for you. The software, you know, operating the software of the cloud still is a necessity. However, you know, for developers like us that like to play with software, that's not so difficult to do. And this is one of your points in your talk was that, you know, these are the configuration settings that I've broken out for my app. You know, I can do this. I'm a developer, but I can do it. It's not that difficult.
Well, if you think, okay, if I go back to the era of 2000-ish,
mm-hmm.
you know, I had to do a 24/7 operation in the insurance industry, which means our partners that we needed data from were very demanding. They were very large companies. They were Fortune 500 companies. And their first question was, you know, how do I know you can back up and recover? How do I know how you're securing the data? How do I know that if there's an earthquake in California, you're not going to go away? You know, you need to have a backup also in New York. And about a week later, they had the blackout. But anyway.
I blame me. But you're right. You end up spending millions of dollars to stand up all this infrastructure.
$750,000 to get that startup off the ground because we went with Solarix equipment. We went with Oracle because our customers said only Oracle.
Right.
Very, very caro. That means very
expensive
in Spanish.
I remember, you know, Oracle's licensing model. So how much money you got.
Yeah.
No, truly. And you have to license the software upgrades or else you can't actually have the product and
right.
you don't get the upgrades and you don't get the support. And then not only that, equipment and having enough, you know, to scale out and having promise of replacement equipment, and you have to pay for that with vendors. So
mm-hmm.
think of all of that organization, which clearly we wouldn't have to do today, but it was a ton of work.
Right. Just to get Hello World.
And
just to get live and to have it on the right type of equipment and environment that we could somehow prove to customers you can trust us.
But it's just plumbing.
Iron, you know?
It's still plumbing, really. It's hardware plumbing, but it's the same way that we use frameworks and software so we can stop writing plumbing.
And we still couldn't see those servers.
Sure.
After we got it in the colo facility, after we had it set up with the internet connectivity and the redundant internet connectivity, everything redundant.
Yep.
We didn't really go in physically to the machines very often, right? I mean, in fact, sometimes, eventually, you know, when the MSPs came about, you never saw the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So really, why shouldn't that be a commodity? It makes sense why we're here today, which it should be no surprise. I mean, we're here, and it's going to stay.
So for a startup company, this is ideal because it's minimal, if none, no cash laid out up front. It's all based on how much you use the service.
I have spent
$0.
$0.
So you're in the midst of a startup right now?
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, so thanks for the lead-in.
I'm here to serve. Find a way.
No, you know, I'm in the midst of, you know, after actually several in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
So the one that I'm in the midst of right now is a curation product for, you know, collecting and organizing links of content. You might call it your favorite content, but, you know, there's different reasons and templates that we're building for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's research purposes, education purposes.
It's also good for sharing.
In general, sharing. And also private. Never, don't dismiss the value of private, you know, Snapboard. I mean, that's the idea would be I could have all of my stuff. You know, I
talk Snapboard, that's what it's called?
Snapboard is the name of the business.
Snapboard.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Snapboard.com. So, yeah.
So you were saying the private Snapboard.
Yeah, like a private Snapboard would be all the things I look at every day, you know, like these, you know, places for my son's education stuff or
mm-hmm.
Places that I frequently go to check status of bills and so forth, places that I go, you know, to log in, even if it's, you know, Windows Azure, I know how to type that out, so that's not a big deal. But there's an awful lot of other links that have longer links, and I have to go keep finding them or drill down, and it's just nice to have it at my fingertips. So.
And it's not buried in document letters somewhere, right?
Exactly, because, you know, right, have you ever had documents where you save links? You're doing research project on security or something.
Which document is that
and
in?
And you're like, where did I put those again? So I end up Googling again, right? And then I find different stuff, and, you know, it's just nice to be able to go, plop, snap it.
One of the best features of the personalization of Google's homepage was this little thing that you could just like a sticky note that you could put in. And once the guys in my company found that, oh my god, like all the what we call the introductions for the shows, they would put those in there because that was the only place that was outside of their network.
Just having a place you can go to and have contact.
This is sort of like that on steroids.
Well, and really the longer-term vision is that you would be able to also upload content and post it with us up to a certain amount, you know, so think of it like an organized Dropbox.
Right, an organized Dropbox.
And then eventually you could, like, have an e-commerce engine behind it and sell stuff. So, I mean, we do have a premium plan, right?
Yeah. Right.
You know, the professional version will have other features, but we're talking to a lot of corporations about that kind of stuff because the larger businesses are the ones that will actually pay us, you know, earlier and kind of want to have some money in the door to show that we can run a business.
So you haven't taken external funding yet?
No.
Really? So self-funded so far?
Because self-funded $0 equals,
But you are running it on Azure. There must be some money being spent on Azure.
Zero.
Really?
I have a BizSpark account.
Oh, okay. So you're into BizSpark.
We're BizSpark, and we're actually BizSpark Plus, but I haven't kicked that off yet because when I kick that off, I get a year of $60,000 free. So that means when we're ready to start streaming media, I'll need to start that off.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
So I don't want to kick that off until we're actually needing to use that because right now I can run it off the basic BizSpark.
So I saw.
And we're not even using that. Yeah,
but I thought BizSpark was just you got software for Microsoft. Like, what all's in BizSpark?
No, BizSpark is a plan that gives you essentially not only MSDN software, which is also useful for the development team. But it also gives you Azure services. So think of it like with your MSDN account, you've got an Azure subscription.
Sure.
And in there, you have a certain number of hours you can use, which usually equivalent would be two extra small instances for the entire month for free.
Okay.
So that's why it's kind of cool if you're a small business, extra small instance times two, you don't pay anything on the basic BizSpark or on the basic MSDN subscription.
So if you just own an MSDN subscription, and
that's
pretty much if you own a copy of Studio, you own an MSDN subscription.
And you can see how much you're using, so you can sort of monitor that and make sure that you're not going over it. You can actually set it up to where it stops functioning
before it starts billing.
The billing point, that might be bad for a startup because then it shuts down. So
yeah, last week of each month, we don't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
But with the now you're talking about a $60,000 level. Like, well, what was
that's
that?
That's BizSpark Plus.
Okay.
So BizSpark Plus is a program you have to probably ask to get into.
Well, I got to mention you have to get in anyway.
Start up and sort of look at, you know, what kind of services you're going to use and whether or not you'll need that. And I guess you have to qualify.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
but isn't that true of all BizSpark roles? Like, how did you get into BizSpark?
No, I think BizSpark is automatic. Right. I mean, any startup that's not making any, you know, up until, what is it, 3 million or a million a year or something? So the first 3 years, unless you start making money.
Okay.
Right? So, like, if I start making a million a year, I suppose I'm paying our team, in which case I'm not too worried about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Zero risk.
So you just
really
signed
zero
up.
Risk. I just literally signed up, and I was able to start pushing stuff out there and not have it charge me. So we have to watch it, you know, and the things that make everybody nervous right up front is, but how do I know how much bandwidth is really going to be used, right?
Right.
So I put together this monster pricing sheet. I actually have that on my blog so people can look at it, and I keep refining it over time, you know, as our business evolves, because our pricing model against Azure costs is changing slightly with our new sort of, you know, business model. But the point is the costs, you know, of Azure, you have to kind of go down and look. What does bandwidth usage mean? And, you know, if you're streaming media, then it could mean you have to figure out what's an average size of that media, right? If I was letting people host content with me, then if every piece of content is, like, you know, 3 meg, let's say, or even 50, then I got to do the math, right? Like if five users reach your one content, and if on average five users hit everybody's content, and you multiply that by how many people push content, then I can come up with a calculation that gives me some sort of amount, and then I can play with those numbers in the spreadsheet and kind of figure out what bandwidth usage I've got and map that to the costs, and then subtract the BizSpark free stuff and see where my costs lie. And if you look at the spreadsheet that's already on my blog,
which is at
michellelarubasdemonte.com.
Oh.
Say that fast three times.
Michellelarubasdemonte.com.
No, with one L.
Michelle with one L. I have to spell all three of my names because nobody can spell any of them, including my first name. Isn't that horrible?
It's awesome.
I got to change it to Michelle Busta or something.
So it's dasblonde.net.
Dasblonde.net does link to it. So if you can spell dasblonde with an E at the end,
you
and
get
don't
there.
Search Google for that because you're going to get all kinds of interesting names. Just saying. I picked that blog name sitting beside a German who didn't warn me.
I remember.
That was Clemens. Nice job.
Yeah. Thanks, Clemens.
Yeah. Anyway.
And we will put the links on the show so people can just go.
Yeah.
So it's a great big expense calculator kind of chart.
Right. And the biggest expense, I mean, the end result of our evaluation, when I did an analysis assuming content was being hosted in the service, which means the heavy usage of bandwidth, people downloading and looking at videos and podcasts and things like that.
Right.
That was where most of the costs lie.
Streaming.
Bandwidth. Everything else almost was free, looking at the BizSpark, returns.
Right.
And then only the bandwidth, you exceed that pretty fast if you're doing big pieces of content. So that's where that kind of business, you got to have a plan around, those costs. Now, how much is a lot?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's, $1,000 a month, that seems a lot if it's just me or just me and my co-founders and we have no budget and no funding. I mean, I don't particularly want to spend $1,000 a month just for fun.
But it's still.
I mean, I'd rather buy shoes, right?
It's
a sacrifice, man.
If you're monetizing your product, though, you may get that back.
But that's what I was going to say if it's costing me $1,000 a month, then I probably have X number of users. So that should show traction, which means I should be able to get funding.
Right.
And the next step, of course, is yes, but at some point the customers have to pay. When does that kick in?
Right.
And that's where, it helps in order to get funding to know somebody would actually pay, which means a customer who not just says, oh, yeah, I'd use that, because, people say that all the time, and then do they?
Right. I'd use it if it was free.
They got to prove it by putting time in with you.
Right.
Because if they won't even put the time in to help you develop it, they don't need it bad enough.
Right.
In which case, you haven't found your customer base.
Yeah, what you want is people frustrated with your product. I mean, they care enough about it to miss the things that aren't there.
And then maybe pay for those things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would you pay $50 a year for this? Like, it's a question. Right?
And what's the hook? What's the piece that gets them wanting to pay?
Exactly.
I look at TripIt was great for this. TripIt was free. It did all these great things. But they had the pro account, which I think was $50 a year.
Right.
And the one thing it did that mattered to me most is it sends me a text message about my next flight. So while I'm still on the plane, I turn the cell phone on, and bing, there's that message that says, your next flight's delayed, so you know what you've got to do
next.
And
they do it before the airline
does,
which I get those all the time after I've already boarded. I'm like, dude, thanks for letting me know that. Yeah.
But that's $50 a year. You bet. I'll pay that in a second.
I love that trial model where you get certain features, and then you make them miss the features that they want rather than giving them a trial period where they get all the features and suddenly,
take it away. You
can't cut and paste anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You're out of there.
Yeah. No, if you really want to cut and paste, you're going to have to pay us some money. It feels like it's
LinkedIn
working.
Does that. They always give you this, this many people checked your profile. That actually intrigued me.
Yeah.
I'm like, who is looking at my profile? I never thought of that. And I went, and then, of course, it shows you, three people, and it says, but there's, 20 more if you want to know.
You got to pay.
Yeah.
But it's a good hook.
It's a good hook, but, what's your relationship with LinkedIn now?
It kind of
feels like, hey, I got all the answers right here. You just got to give me a little money. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. You like that?
Nice.
All right. More Marlon Brando. I'll make a note of that.
Okay.
Yes, please do.
But this is not a straight line path. You don't necessarily know what you need to do next, I've got to think you're really wrestling with the pricing model for Snapboard.
Yeah. Well, you have to start with something,
right?
And then you have to start running it by people.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, because you definitely don't want to go up after you go live.
Right.
It's better to bring the price down.
Sure.
But you don't want to charge so much that people
just drop them
walk
off.
Away. But there's another theory to that, and that is, don't be afraid of the first people walking away. You know, like if you put up that minimum viable product, and there are people that see it and say, you know, I'm not going to use this.
Mm-hmm.
For as many people as there are that will not use it or tell you, there might be people that will actually tell you. And that feedback is so good for your business.
Mm-hmm.
You can afford to lose those first couple people that didn't stay, because you're going to learn from the people that cared to tell you, and then you're going to make it better. And then the next group, the next wave, you know, you have to be prepared for that process.
One thing that intrigued me about your demo was that you showed hotspots where people were clicking on the website. And they're basically these little things that show you where on your website people are clicking. How is that possible?
So there are a lot of tools. There's this thing called Visual Website Optimizer.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example of many. And a lot of these are free. They do the model where you have to pay after a month and very rudely shut it down. And we lost our test from last month. But I rigged it up one more time just because I didn't have time to research another tool just yet.
Sure.
But there's a lot of free tools, like User Voice is awesome, and they've got a lot of free services. There's still a paid service. But
if you think of like a JavaScript programmer, he's thinking, you know, all I've got to do is sit and hang in the background, and when they click, find out that X and Y coordinate and send that to a service.
That's exactly what they do. I mean, you stick in a little JavaScript, and it's the same JavaScript across all the pages, and if you have a common base page in your MVC app, then it's all
brilliant
there.
Idea.
It's brilliant.
In one shot, in one picture, you find where the clusters of clicks are and what people are clicking on they shouldn't be clicking on.
But
it's
you know what's
really
interesting?
It's an elevator button problem in software.
You know what's really funny? I remember in 1997, I worked at a business where we had a usability person, and she would go around and annoy everybody and force us to sit and go through these, like, paper flows, you know, workflows, and like, okay, now where would you click here and here?
Right.
Really, really time-consuming stuff, and it was the thing of the day.
Right.
And not everybody did it as a business, but this particular business invested in that type of person. Today, you don't even need that because there are all these tools, and it's not just the heat map that tells you, oh, people are clicking this area I didn't expect. That tells me something, right? I should respond to that. But you get the number of clicks. So I didn't show you a different screen where you can actually hover, and it'll show you they're never clicking in this area. They're clicking on this text area, and, like, the percentages of the clicks on the page that went here or here or here. So you get some sort of metrics on, you know, how often people prefer to go here than here.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, I don't have to do anything, and I got all that information just like that.
Mm.
So it takes me, 2 minutes to evaluate that and learn, you know?
Doesn't this speak to a larger ideal of, you know, you don't necessarily know what your customer wants or uses or anything like that? Like, get
you
as much.
You, do.
You think we always think we do.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to cast the customer as us.
Right.
And I think we're wrong. You know, I like that you said minimal viable products. Like, ship the fewest number of things so that you can be influenced as early as possible.
Absolutely.
And
it's so hard to do,
though. That's just what DevOps is all about, right? You're
right.
Instrumenting your code and letting the code tell you. Let the customer tell you without even knowing it what they're doing. And then you can make another iteration and use that data to make better features.
Yeah. And if you don't do that, if you don't start with minimum, do you know how hard it was for me, like, I mean, any developer, right? You don't want to show people your code when you're not done, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Because nobody, even when you're done, likes another person's code. I mean, you're going to rewrite it. It's like, you know. But in addition, what about UI? Even worse. I mean, and I'm not a designer. I absolutely suck at design. Like, absolutely 150% suck. If I had to do this startup without a designer, I don't know how I would get it done. However, the interesting thing is I could go through that first phase.
Mm-hmm.
I really could. And you know what? I could probably even go to the MVP. It just wouldn't look as pretty.
Right.
When you say MVP.
The minimum viable product. I could probably even go live with an MVP. I would have to struggle and fight and sweat to get some decent looking UI because I just suck at it.
Yeah.
But I could get something up that's decent enough with an image and a graphic and a pretty border, and then that would be all I could do. And you shouldn't be afraid to do that because you'll hear from the people. And that very early stage, when we went to a customer that wanted to sort of use us as a corporate resource center, and we didn't have the pretty UI yet, and we're like, if I want to talk to this guy. And the first thing he said, I told you in the speech, is,
how ugly.
Oh. And you could hear his voice. He didn't say, your shit's ugly. He didn't say that. But what he did is he said, he was sort of like, And you could see that he wasn't engaged, right, in the conversation at all. And I think to myself, damn it, it's the UI. I know it. And so I tried to push him in the direction of, okay, so what is the problem you're trying to solve? Because he had a problem he wanted to solve already. Mm-hmm. And he started talking. And then when he clicked the links, you know, he was like, okay, yeah, you know, I'd really like to see this and this and this and this. And this is kind of how I'd like to use it. Can I send this to my marketing person so she can look at it and we can play with it? And we said, we'll give you a link that you can actually create your own board. It's going to be cumbersome as heck. We don't have our tools in place for you to browse and snap yet, so it's going to be literally super cumbersome.
Right.
And he's like, that's fine, because he just wanted to feel that he could build the resource center, right?
But I also
think... Anyway, at the end, I just wanted to say is, at the end of that, we showed him a mock, a picture of the pretty UI that was coming. And he goes, oh, that's awesome. Can I send that to my marketing person? So, I mean, it totally proves, of course, better UI is good. But he was still engaged before that. You just have to be brave enough to say, okay, I'm going to do it, you know?
But what I really appreciate about that whole situation is, if you'd had the UI, he would have focused on the UI. You wanted him to focus on the features, and that's all he could see was the features. So it was maybe that initial resistance. Once he got in, like, you got the right engagement.
True. You know what? I'm glad you said that, because you're right. That's exactly right.
I want the right engagement. I want a guy who cares about the feature set, not how it looks.
Yep.
He doesn't care about the feature set, the rest is not important.
Well, and I can tell you a good story about that, because the startup prior to this one that shall not be named because it never happened,
right?
It had a name that now will never be used.
Right.
But we went through a different process, and it was a different, slightly different founding group. And one of the focuses was it had to be a killer UI experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, literally, we spent a year and a half, I'm kidding you not, under the direction of you know, a team, where our plan was first this, and then, okay, that UI looks good, but, you know, it's not enough. We're going to have to build this and then show the VC. And then we built that, and then, no, it's not enough, so we got to add this, because that's like the end game. That way we can show them the whole roadmap with three series of things to deploy.
Yeah.
You know what? We spent, like, way too much time. It was stupid, because basically the goal was, if the UI is killer, people are going to love it. And that was absolutely the wrong attitude.
Wow.
And I'm glad I saw that happening, because I learned from it.
Yeah,
and
great education.
My instincts told me, why should the UI have to be good? If somebody doesn't need this bad enough, like, we've got a problem, right?
Yeah.
The UI shouldn't matter that much, because that means we're not solving a problem. But, you know, even though that's kind of how I felt, it just sort of, we had this momentum, and you get caught up in it, and then you realize, oh, boy, yeah, that was dumb.
Richard, guess what time it is?
Must be that happy time again.
It's the time in the middle of the show where we get to give away stuff.
I love it.
So, if you guys here in the audience don't know what we're talking about, on the .NET Rocks page, there's this Get Free Stuff button. You click on that, and you can join the .NET Rocks fan club. And the .NET Rocks fan club allows you to win stuff. So, what we're giving away today is a Telerik DevCraft Complete Collection.
Nice.
Which is everything that they do in one box, including support. It was worth a couple of grand. And our winner today is Carlos Redondo.
Ah, congratulations, Carlos. Big hand for Carlos. Normally we do a golf clap, but since we have all these hands,
that's
we can get a big clap.
Carlos, everybody say hi to Carlos.
Hi, Carlos.
Awesome. He's feeling very special right now.
All right, and in December, we're going to give away the big prize. We're still arguing over what it's going to be, but $5,000 worth of technology.
We set aside $5,000 for a lucky winner that we get to handpick what they want. Maybe we'll give them a couple of options.
Yeah. Well, I think during the road trip, we were arguing about this, but right. I'm still hooked on the whole MakerBot thing, a 3D printer.
Would you like a 3D printer?
Yeah.
There you go.
And with a computer, I mean, for $5,000, we can get a 3D printer and a computer, maybe a Wacom tablet so you can help draw out the objects, all the software, like that could be a complete 3D printing solution, about $5,000.
And a Surface, maybe.
Yeah, maybe need some kind of computer. Maybe it should be a Surface. I don't know. Yeah. I was going to be specific.
And by Surface, I mean the tablet.
Yeah, not the table.
Not the table.
Yeah, which is now called pixels.
But we found, speaking of 3D printers, you told me yesterday that they just made a guitar with a 3D printer.
Through a 3D printer, which is crazy, but
that's
yes.
Crazy.
Now,
a playable guitar.
Playable guitar. The hollow body is plastic.
Yeah.
And they got good resonance out of it. And then there was a set of stainless steel components they made with a sintering 3D printer. But this, we're going to have to do a geek out just on additive manufacturing. So they're, it's not just making, little Warhammer 30,000 things out of plastic. It's also the metal construction. There's a lot of different technologies. This whole idea of rather than carving stuff away,
right,
making stuff, assembling it up. Yeah,
time.
Or maybe not quite that,
Is this one of those because I can things?
Yeah, probably.
Now, I think additive manufacturing is a very big change overall.
We can talk for hours about that.
Now we're going to do a whole other show right there.
But Michelle, if we told you we have $5,000 for you to spend on technology, it doesn't have to be developer or anything, what would you want?
A whole lot of snapboards? No.
No shoes. Shoes don't count.
Oh, I can't have shoes?
You can't have shoes.
No. We could put technology in shoes.
Technology shoes?
Okay, if you gave it that much, what I would want? I would want, I don't have one of the tablets yet.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'd want a tablet, but...
You can't spend $2,000 about that for
a lot of tablets.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of tablets. So a tablet and shoes. No. a tablet and probably... That's a really good question. I want a new upgraded flip with all the devices for recording.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Some software for making cool videos.
A video recording rig.
Nice video camera and really nice video recording type of
And the software set up on a machine. That's a great idea.
The stuff I saw back there today.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought that rocked.
This whole studio
this
setup?
Whole panning.
That's a great idea.
I want that for my house just for fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it.
A video
rig.
Yeah.
I love that.
You can definitely do that.
Sure. Yeah, $5,000 is perfect. That's awesome.
All right, where were we?
I was going to jump back into this whole conversation about the minimal viable product being influenced by the customer and getting away from the UI, like focusing on the real feature. In fact, you want that feature to be so compelling that they'll fight through the awkward UI to use that feature. Like that to me seems to, if you make it glitzy and easy, anybody will play with it. Right? They just, they're in awe of how pretty your UI is.
Right.
To make a feature that, even though the UI sucks, I still want this.
Right.
That to me seems like you're getting real data there.
Right.
You're not just humoring yourself with people liking how pretty your stuff is. They're getting into the feature that matters and you're fighting for
right.
it.
Exactly. Looks, just the surface.
I'm still wrestling with how do you know you have a minimal viable product?
So you have to go through the feedback phase.
Mm-hmm.
The early feedback phase would be when you're talking to people about really the core features that will go into the minimum viable product. So, it's hard to say without an example. So
right.
for us, the example was, look, what's the core of the product? I should be able to put links I care about into category buckets, and I should be able to, after I do that, drill down and get at them quickly and get to those pages. Like, that's the core of the product. It's
mm-hmm.
just basic. There's all kinds of stuff. So, that's like future, right?
That's
it's
future.
Like roadmap.
Right.
But, until you have a mass of content, search is useless. Right.
Right.
Sure. So it's
easy to find stuff when there's any stuff.
It's I need this, I need a board, I need to organize stuff. So that's all I need to show. And I don't even have to show. So this is maybe a good example to give you an idea. We know that you have to have a browser plugin
mm-hmm.
to be able to,
snap
browse
stuff.
Around and snap stuff, right?
Yeah.
Just like with Pinterest, you go to a site, you click it, and say, I want to pin it, and then they've got this tool, and then it brings up, images you can choose, and it's super easy, right? It's the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we have prototypes of those, but we didn't show it to the customer on
right.
purpose. Because just the fact that the customer would say, are you going to give me a, even though we already think we know the answer,
right.
isn't it good to hear that?
Yeah, that's
so rather than showing it in advance, as an obvious thing we're going to do, let them ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it tells you, yes, they want that.
Yes.
It validates you, because you think it's obvious.
And you say, that's a great idea. You're mm-hmm. right.
The far more telling thing.
Other people talking about completely different things.
Right.
Like, I said, you got a link to your Twitter or this or that. And they're like, but can I get, a consolidation of my Twitter and my Facebook feeds and then have that show right there? They're giving me feature ideas,
interesting.
Right?
And if you had led with the plugin, they probably never would have talked about that.
Yeah, if I had led with other things we want to do with RSS or
right.
this or that. If I told them the roadmap,
yeah.
then basically I'm not going to hear them say maybe some other idea.
Well,
not only that, but you're setting them up for disappointment. Like, you're telling them all the things that they can't have. Well, me with the Kinect today, right? Kinect is sponsoring the road trip, but I don't have any now. So I just thought I'd tell you that to disappoint you.
Right.
There's really a technique here about how to be willing to be wrong. Don't feed too much information. Like, actually let them guide you. Don't guide them.
Right.
That's not
it's
easy.
It's really, really, really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you, especially.
Because you want to show your best, right?
Yeah.
It's like going out without makeup on.
I know.
all the time. But I also think that, you know, we're in the business of solving problems. And we tend to just want to solve them rather than to be influenced.
Oh, and if I told you how many times I have conversations, like, with my, two developers on our team,
sure.
Right? And how many times we'll, like, have, like, discussions about ideas, and they're like, oh, I should prototype that. It's like, dude, like,
easy.
Like, we actually have to have, you know, stick to the plan.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to get the minimum viable product out if you try to do it all. Mm-hmm. And it's so obvious. You have this long list of things you know you want to do, and you want to attack all of it. And then you start feeling like, oh, my God, I have to have money in the account before we can attack all of this. But you don't. Do just the basics and do it cheaply. And let's start seeing if you can show traction, because that's the number one thing that will get you money.
Right.
That barring customers paying, which is another way to get money, but you need more of that. So it's probably better to get a little influx of seed capital or something. If it's a real business, you know.
Should you be a skeptic of your own product then? I mean, you keep pushing back on this.
Yeah.
That's
because
interesting.
Because you know what?
You have to be a believer.
How many companies fail?
Lots. Most.
Lots and lots and lots fail. But why do they fail? I mean, it's been discussed here and there amongst many, many of the lean startup people.
Right.
So I'm not innovating here by saying that you fail when you don't listen. You fail when you don't find the customer that you're looking for. One of the startups that I was talking to, I go to these startup meetups in San Diego. And really great group of guys. They do messaging. They have a core messaging framework product that you will automatically let you SMS or Facebook message between people, and you can build a UI in front of it. So, like, for our product, Snapboard, we could have, like, comments underneath the snaps.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I write all that code, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to use somebody else's product because that's not my core business.
Yeah, and it's a known technology.
And I should see if people even want to use messaging before I go and spend developer time on that.
And again, it's that scenario. You want people coming to you going,
right.
I need messaging here.
But, you know, when they got to a framework, they actually didn't start out planning to build a framework.
Hmm.
They got there because they had customers they were working with, and it landed to where they pivoted the business plan.
Wow.
Because originally they were going to do all the UI, and they had other plans, some of which details I'm not privy to. But he said, we pivoted big time to become an API because we found a big customer that wanted to pay for that.
Right.
And so they've got enough with that customer to launch them into the next phase of the business.
That also sounds hazardous, too, that you end up building a product for a specific customer and not one for any other customer.
Well, they have plans for the masses on the same API framework.
Right.
So that, in general, was a shift that this is what people want.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes, they've got a big customer that's taking over a little in order for them to meet their needs. But I don't think that's bad, because now they're going to have a customer that's loyal, that's getting them off the ground, while still they have this list of minimum viable features they're still going to get in, and then they're going to go live with that and continue to satisfy their roadmap, right?
Yeah, I do think it's a
gives them some stability.
It's got to be a balancing act, though, because the customer's going to keep demanding more. Hey, we've given you money, you know, and put a lot of pressure on you to go that direction.
You have to have agreements.
Yeah. Well, I think you've also got to keep your eye on the horizon, too. What was the long-term goal here? Was it to support this guy, or was it to build this other product?
There's really no way to guarantee that except for to work with the customer and say, okay, what is it that you want as priority set of features, and then you line that up with your roadmap, and you have to come to some agreement on a plan. And I'm sure you do that before they give you money.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's part of the challenge.
There's got to be some trust relationship there.
I also think those things are going to change over time. Like, you may go off the track from there.
Yeah. But you're right about staying on the roadmap, because you're right. You don't want to deviate from the long-term vision.
Yeah, but money is almost poisonous in that scenario, isn't it?
It can be if they take you too far away from your vision.
Sure.
But if it's like, for us, we've got a customer potential, and they really kind of want what we've already done.
Nice.
And the only thing we would add, let's say, to satisfy them that we wouldn't have done MVP is some of the branding capabilities that people, you know, might pay for in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you about you mentioned really quickly some of these tools that you've used, in your startup?
Yeah.
And let's burn down the list because, the tools that you use, I think, are valuable to the people because they're good enough for you.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, Google Analytics is really good for, mm-hmm. for tracking and measuring. You saw a bit of a sort of, I would say, a comparative tool to that in my screenshots, which was the Visual Website Optimizer.
Mm-hmm.
They only do so much, right? They give you the immediate visual stuff, so we started with that.
The heat map stuff.
And they do other things like conversion rates, like how many people came to our front page that actually clicked the sign up button.
Mm-hmm.
That conversion rate's really important. It
sure.
tells you that when the page is working. It tells you that people are compelled to sign up or click that button. So it doesn't have to be a sign up. It could be how many people, when they get to this page, click here. The ads,
mm-hmm.
are the ads working? Are people hitting our ads? I mean,
right.
you're going to have your own internal metrics to get, if you're tracking ads, to say how many people are clicking so that you can give those metrics to the ad company.
And did Google Analytics slow down your product at all? Did you find that you had to move it to the footer?
No. But the thing is Google Analytics has a lot of layers, and you
right.
can play with it in your own way.
Okay.
A great video on that, just a plug for my buddy Zoinder Tejada, too,
because
mm-hmm. he did a Pluralsight video on how to use Google Analytics. Scream.
Everybody scream.
Now.
Nice.
Take that.
Yeah.
We're
getting noise from the next room.
That's right.
Excited.
Everybody's a little excited. You said Google Analytics and the room went crazy.
Yeah, I know. but you do want those metrics, right? So
right.
So imagine this. We put so little code up just to get the request invite live.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that to start getting the word out, right?
Right.
And then we added samples. So one of the biggest things that was important to us is that we're actually measuring those things.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get something in quick and easy.
Right.
Because if I don't gather that information, putting that live is useless to me.
Yeah.
Because now I have no sense, except for the actual sign-ups, of how many people visited and didn't. And that's important to me, right? Or when you get in and look at the samples, how many people went in and didn't click at all and said, screw this, I'm out of here, You want to know that. So the conversions are important. So those are good tools. User Voice is really cool because they do all User Voice. They have a feedback tool, so you can have actually a whole forum where people can talk about your product. And
nice.
We've built one too, but we haven't linked it to the site yet. So that gives you a way for people to have random conversations, post things I wish I had.
Yeah.
And it's free. I mean, there's paid services, but there's a lot of free stuff you can do with User Voice, including
nice.
Polls, asking questions. The poll that we did, we used another tool for that, but I think I would go to User Voice in future,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Just because they've got a more robust free model.
And stuff you can just pick up with
and
JavaScript.
It's like JavaScript. You plug it in and you're done, just quickly tell me which logo color did you like, whatever.
Great.
Yeah.
So how are you doing A-B testing with this, or are you doing
that
A-B testing?
That was Visual Website Optimizer,
right.
And I love A-B testing. It's awesome.
So you're putting up two different versions of the site at the
right.
same time?
So what you do is you have your main site, say www.snapboard.com, and then you have like another URL, like say b.snapboard.com or whatever it is you decide to do. In our case, we did it with websites,
mm-hmm.
so we did it with the free version, so it wasn't actually the Snapboard URL. So it was just,
right.
Whatever. Anyway, you link up two links. One of them is the one people hit, and they randomly send people to the other one.
Okay.
And then they do the heat maps, but comparatively, so you can compare them side by side to see people are more engaged on A or B, and that gives you an idea which UI is working better for
them. And they don't know they're being tested. They're just
they don't know
product.
They're being tested.
Yeah.
Right.
No.
Which is, I think, really important.
Really important.
I love that. And it can make sure that the same person always gets back to the B if that's where they went, so that they keep experiencing that, so you can see how often they go back and use and interact with your site. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, how long would you run an A-B test like that?
As long as you need to get enough input.
Right.
So I think that's a really...
So days?
That's a judgment. It
yeah.
could be weeks. It could
weeks.
Be... I would imagine weeks is about right, because
right.
if you're actively updating your product...
It really comes back to the velocity of your site, too.
...together new pages to test with, right? Or new screens to test with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our next A-B test would be around how do you snap things. Our A-B test after that might be... how do you view a snap that's actually content hosted with us or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
It could be anything. So, yeah.
Cool.
There's lots of different things.
Well, is there anything else that you want to tell us about Snapboard before we
Not specifically. I mean, I think it's more important maybe if anybody has questions about startups and Azure, I mean, then we answer those. So.
Sure. Well, we were just ready to wrap, I think, but I think we can take a couple questions.
Any questions from the audience?
Before we wrap, let's take questions, but I want to cut that out.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you have any questions for Michelle from the audience? All right.
Hang on, sir. Just in general, it's like when I speak very generally, how do you get customers to come in and look at your product?
So just getting somebody to the Snapboard site.
Yeah. So I tweeted that, and I got a bunch of people from that. I was actually afraid to. All my five followers, I'd say, all came at once. What would happen? I don't tweet a lot. I should. And that's a big problem because you actually need to build a following.
Sure.
I have an advisor, Mr. Daniel Egan, who's
going to help
me understand how I can better leverage the social stuff, because I have to admit I'm not the best at it, right? I'm so busy.
But it really came down to you tweeted and you got some traffic.
I did. I first went to Facebook because I wanted to do it sort of more privately just to see what happened. I was nervous, right?
Right.
And then I tweeted and I got a bunch more.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few people retweeted,
right?
And so then that expanded. But again, out of those tweets, I mean, think about it. It's all a numbers game. How many people you have following you? I mean, somebody has 30,000. There might only be 100 that actually looked at that tweet, and maybe only 50 of those will actually go to the site.
Right.
So if you only have 1,000 followers, like maybe 2 people are going to go to your site, right?
Sure.
So then I emailed some of my internal list to say, hey, guys, friends, you know, could you, like, hit it for me? Like, I just want to get some metrics. And that was not really about customer feedback. That was more about getting metrics.
Right.
So I think if you don't have a following on Twitter or people to go to that way, it becomes more challenging, I suppose.
Well, like, because it's sort of just in the friends and family phase. If you really want a customer, it's like give me a customer that doesn't have a previous relationship with you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I guess you'd have to be out there blogging. You'd have to be out there on maybe TechCrunch and some of the startup communities to try to build a buzz. So you've got to have somebody proactive on how do we market. And that's one of the reasons I'm going to start not having as much time to code, for example, even though I can.
And hey, let's give Michelle Arubasamonte another great big round of applause. I'll see you next time on Twitter.